Today is an exceptional day, in that we have Dave Anderson with us. And you may have already heard of Dave Anderson and know part of his story, but if you haven't, Dave was the last passenger off the fated flight on January 15th, 2009, the U.S. Airways flight 1549. And he was the last person off, and that event has changed his life. Dave, I want to welcome you to Habitudes.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm extremely excited to be with you, Scott, and I was very honored and humbled to be the last passenger off the plane that day.
Dave is a highly acclaimed international speaker, and you're going to be able to hear his story, but he's also an author of a book called Moments That Matter. And Dave, just before we get into that event, can you tell us a little bit about Dave Sanderson before that event in 2009?
I can. I don't know how exciting it may be, but I had 30 plus years of sales experience, primarily in technology sales for probably the last 25 years before that. 5 years before that was primarily in copiers and doing what the basic salespeople do, learn the basics. In addition to being in sales and sales management, I was also the director of security for a gentleman named Tony Robbins. And
yeah, I think we've heard of him.
Had an opportunity to travel with Mr. Robbins and learn and absorb everything that he taught, being just in his presence, which is one of the things I talk about proximity is power, being around people who can really impact you as a this is just a great way to sort of absorb what they do. So for that, the 30 plus years after before that, I was in sales and doing director of security for Tony. I had a wife of four kids, very active in a lot of local activities with the church and some other, my board of directors at James Madison University's Alumni Association. So I had the opportunity to do a lot of things.
Fair enough. Now, a lot of folks, certainly fans of Tony Robbins work here. Just a quick segue. How did you get in touch with Tony and become, head of security?
Well, it was by happenstance. So I attended his seminars, and I actually got results because I actually did what he taught, which is very rare that people do.
That helps, doesn't it?
Taking action does help. But then, I got to the point where it was costing so much money, and my wife was not really a fan of me heading out and doing these having fun in Hawaii kind of things. So I started volunteering, and how it happened is I volunteered for an event, and I think it was in 1996. And I was one of those people just volunteer, putting up brochures at midnight, right? Doing my thing, right? Like everybody else does, just serving. There to serve, but being around the energy, right?
Yeah.
But his former wife was in a situation where two gentlemen were talking to her, and she looked a little uncomfortable. So all I did is go up and say, Mrs. Robbins, your husband needs you in the back. That's all I said.
Yeah.
She said, thank you, and left. I escorted her back. She said, you handled that pretty well. Would you like to be on Tony's security team? I'm like, internally, I'm saying, man, it's a lot better than being handing out brochures, man, So she put me in his green room in his back door. I basically guarded the back door for 4.5-5 days. That's all I did, sit there, not move.
Yeah.
But I watched, right? And I was watching what was going on and sort of meeting the people. And Tony got more secure with me, right? He trusted me. And so probably about 6 months later, after just sitting there doing stuff, he asked me if I wanted, be on a security team and sit on the stage on left. I'm like, sure. So I'd sit on stage at events. All I'd do is sit on the stage watching his back, right?
Yeah.
Got more credibility with him, right? So he put me on the right side of the stage, which means I was managing him and the stage, which I had more responsibility, being the assistant security director. And then the head of security left. He was going to do something else. So Tony offered me that opportunity to not only manage the team and the stage, but also him and his logistics.
Yeah.
So then I was traveling with Tony all over the world, right, making sure he could do his thing. And I had his back, and I tell people, all I did was make sure that he could do what he did the best.
And this started because you extended an act of kindness.
Right. And just helping his wife out, former wife out.
Yeah. So can you speak to that? Because one of the habitudes we have, and a lot of folks don't recognize the value, both monetary and just intrinsically to do the right thing, is that when you walk around looking to help people, not only are you helping people, but you're also helping yourself in ways that are unseen.
Well, I agree. I think a lot of times, a lot of people, and I was this way for a long time, Scott. I'm not a prince or a choir boy. A lot of people focus on their own personal significance, right? It's all about me. What can I get out of it? But when you go with an attitude of contribution, and volunteering for this like that, that's what you do. You're there to contribute and give your time so other people can get the outcomes you got. I think when you go with that attitude of contribution, things come back to you tenfold. And that's what happened to me in many, many different ways. And I just helped his wife out of a situation in Canley. She got some she liked what I did and got to the opportunity, or at least she put me in the back door, and it all started there, man.
Very good. So this question you may have had before, you may not have. So let's go back. We're still pre-event, and you're visioning out 5 years, 10 years to what your career, what your life is going to be like. We're going to find out in a moment what it's become. But before that event, what did you envision actually transpiring?
Well, I was in my, I think, eighth or ninth year at this stint with Oracle. I was actually with PeopleSoft before. So when PeopleSoft got bought, I actually left PeopleSoft to go to KPMG Consulting because I didn't want to be a part of that Oracle world. Mm-hmm. But then my vice president, who I was personal friends with, said, I need you to come in. I need a hunter. I need someone to go after this stuff because everybody wants to be an account manager. So I said, I'll hunt for 4 or 5 years, right? But then I want to sort of transition to either management or something else because I've been doing it for 20-some years, right?
Yeah.
So my game plan was, as I was fulfilling my promise to my vice president, I would come in, I would hunt the big stuff, I would get you some big new business, but we would start transitioning me to a bigger accounts or management. So that was where we were at. I was actually bringing in one of the biggest opportunities at that time. So after that, my next game plan was to either get like 4 or 5 key accounts or be one of the sales managers for an organization, which I was in the Southeast. So I that was my game plan. In addition to being still head of security for Tony, I was doing it at the same time. So Tony and I was rocking with that. I loved that. And it was giving me the energy. And I was learning a lot. Because the things you learn from Tony, I could implement in my business world, right?
Yeah.
So it was a tremendous time. So that was my game plan, but things changed pretty quick.
Yeah, well, they changed quickly. So what I'm hearing from you is you've got 2 full-time gigs, or, you know, not full-time, but very busy gigs. You're a family guy. And then January 15th pops along. Now, I can surmise this, but we've got you on the line. If you've got it within you, can you tell us the story one more time?
So, so January 15th comes. I'm into the 3-day business trip for this potentially big new client that we're working on. And so I was traveling with him from Sarasota, Florida to Petersburg, Virginia, up to New York City. And we were doing manufacturing. They're the manufacturing and distribution company. That's where I was in. So we were doing supply chain, all those checks and basically doing system checks. And the last stop was their big distribution center in Brooklyn, New York. So that's why we were there. And we started a day early because distribution centers open up early. I mean, this would open 2:00 in the morning. So we decided to start our day at 5 so we could be right in the middle of all the action, right? Instead of coming in at 6 or 7 or 8 where all the action is done. Because action starts at like 4:00 to 8:00 in the morning. That's when action starts. So that's why we ended our day about 10. And I had a 5:00 flight. And so I was, you know, I could get out early. I get home early on, you know, Thursday afternoon. This is great. I could take Friday off. So I called the travel agent working with her. She put me on the flight called US Airways 1549, which was turned out to be the Miracle on the Hudson. But there's nothing extraordinary. It was snowing and 11 degrees Fahrenheit. But in New York, that's not that big of a deal, right? I mean, it's the middle of winter. As you know, you're in Canada. You know, it gets cold.
Yep.
So like everybody else, I exchanged my ticket. I was in C-15A and boarded with the first set of passengers because of my status. I was a chairman. Mm-hmm. Went back to my seat and didn't pay attention. I never paid attention because I knew everything. Mm-hmm. Right, like everybody on a plane, they fly, they know everything, so I don't need to listen.
So you're on autopilot at this point.
I'm reading a magazine, right? I'm checking out. I'm just trying to get. I have an hour and 20 minute flight, right? How can I get home an hour and 20 minutes unscathed, right? Just get home. I get so about 60, 70 seconds into the flight, when I heard that explosion, and man, it got my attention because candidly, I had never heard anything on a plane like that before. So
you've just taken out of LaGuardia, right? At this point,
just out of LaGuardia, he was banking down to the ocean. I mean, have you ever taken out as you go out to the bay and start banking? I've done it lots of times, so I knew exactly the flight route. So I looked out the window, I saw fire coming out from the left wing. So, you know, I knew something had happened because I've never seen fire like that on a wing, but you know, planes have multiple engines. I flew so often, they have at least 2 engines, possibly more, depending on what kind of, you know, equipment that you have. So, once again, no big deal. But then when I tell people, one of the saving graces is nobody actually was talking because everybody thought they had the other engine. Because what happened on the right side of the plane, they're probably thinking the same thing I was. And I was thinking, well, they have the other engine on the right. He's just banking, right? So he's going back to LaGuardia.
Okay. Right?
But as we know now, he wasn't banking towards LaGuardia. He was banking the other way down to the Hudson River.
Did they ever figure out, I've heard some stories, I want yours, is what caused the engine failure in the first place?
Yeah, it was Canadian geese. It was a flock of Canadian geese that, you know, were basically based. Rikers Island, which is right outside of that area, that's where they basically would migrate to and then migrate south, right? Mm-hmm. That's what happened. But, you know, somewhere between 20-plus geese hit the plane from the front of the plane into the wing.
Okay.
So that's what knocked him out. But at this point, I'm still not really worried because, you know, yeah, he's going back to the plane, going back to the airport. But
yeah,
we start crossing the George Washington Bridge, and I looked out the window, and all of a sudden you can see people's faces are looking up, and he was pretty close to the bridge. And he only cleared the bridge roughly 400 feet, and the bridge is roughly 600 feet. So at that point, he was roughly 900 to 1,000-plus feet at that point in time.
Yeah.
Descended. That's when he made his famous call, "This is your captain, brace for impact."
Yeah.
And that's when I think we all knew, this is not good. This is pretty serious. And because as soon as he cleared it, because he had to get the nose over to clear it. Once he cleared it, he started putting his nose back down because he had to get speed back up to get to keep the plane up.
Yeah.
So he did that. And that's, of course, he started descending into the river about 60 to 70 seconds later is when he crashed into the river.
So when he said, you know, brace for impact, you've got to remember, what did you feel as soon as he said that?
Well, I knew it was serious. So the first thing I did is this is not looking good. I said, this ain't good. And I started praying immediately. First thing I prayed was that the, you know, whoever that captain is, man, just get me down in one piece. You know, because all I could envision is of all the plane crashes that I've seen, especially water, the ones that are toppling, you know, because they come down and they catch a wing and they start toppling.
Yeah.
So the second thing I said, the last person I spoke with was my client at Brooklyn to call my wife. The third thing I prayed to God to forgive my sins because, Canley, I didn't think we were coming back. At that point in time, I mean, you're just sitting face nose first into a river.
And,
that's what I did is I prayed. I knew it was serious. And that, you know, and then I reached out and got my wallet out and shoved it down into my pants because, you know, at least I wanted an ID on me. Because one of my habits was came on a plane. I put my wallet in my briefcase, pull the magazine out. And that way I had nothing in there. I was just clean, right? There's nothing. Yeah. I started reading. So I got the wallet out and shoved it into my pants.
Yeah.
That way they can at least identify me if something happened.
You had the presence of mind to do that. That's incredible.
Well, we're 60 to 70 seconds out. I didn't know how far we were out.
Yeah.
So you're just going down. So I knew that I needed to have ID on me. Somehow, whether I was dead, whether I was incapacitated, at least they know who I was and could contact next to kin.
Yeah.
Which was on my license, right? Which was on my ID.
Yeah. So now you're impacting in the river there. And I was watching your video on your website, and that's DaveSandersonSpeaks.com. Some great videos there for those who are listening. I would highly encourage you to go over and take a look at that. But, you know, the seats actually broke as you were landing?
Some of the seats broke backwards. Right.
Okay.
So like this, sort of backwards and back. So, and my seat went back like that and it came right back up. So my seat sort of collapsed and came back up. And that's when I sort of opened my eyes up, and I'm like alive. I looked out the window and I saw light. So, hey, that's good stuff. And all of a sudden water's filling the plane and you're feeling water coming up your legs. Right. So it's like, water's in the plane because the way the plane landed, you know, it just collapsed the bottom of the plane and in the back of the plane. Someone tried to open up the door and all of a sudden water's going in all different ways. So water's entering the plane pretty rapidly at this point.
And so how did you get out? I imagine there's a whole bunch of panic going on.
Well, I the term I used that night, and I still say the same term, is called controlled chaos, where no one was losing it in their heads. No one was pushing each other out of the way.
Wow.
But people were moving pretty quick. I mean, it's like, let's get out, right? Go, go, go.
Yeah.
So my game plan was get to the aisle, get up, and get out.
Yeah.
So that was my game plan. But when that happened, when I got to the aisle, as soon as I got there, it was like the first thing I heard in my head from my mother, who died in 1997, was, if you do the right thing, God will take care of you. And I heard her tell me that before when I was a kid. Just do the right thing. God will take care of it.
Yeah.
Right? And I made a quick decision. It's like, well, I'm alive. I didn't know anybody in the back of the plane, how that was going on. So then I start climbing over the seats to get towards the back of the plane. And I got behind the last person, and there was nobody left. And that's why I started making my way out of the plane.
Dave, that's pretty extraordinary that, you know, you twice mentioned now, you know, doing the right thing, the Tony Robbins piece with his ex-wife. And now with your life on the line, your faith is being your guiding talk to that. And has that been something you've been walking with most of your life?
I believe so. And that's one of the reasons we call in my book Moments Matter. It's because I started thinking about all those moments that you don't think that mean anything in your life. And all of a sudden, they're really important because they add up. They're there for a reason, to hopefully either whether to get you to a better place or prepare you for that time when I call it that personal plane crash moment in your life, when something's going to happen.
Yeah.
And so I think all these moments like that, it sort of come back on you, and that's what happened to me. And I think it was just my mother was always about doing the right thing. I mean, my mother was always about, she didn't lie, she didn't smoke, she didn't drink. Yeah. She was about doing the right thing. And hopefully when I tell people, one of the things I've learned about my mother after she passed away and after this was, my mother never really told me what to do. My mother always made me make a choice. And I tell people, I think that's one of the lessons I've learning. And one of the things I wish I had done better raising my kids is helping them make choices so they can understand there's consequences to choices, good or bad consequences.
Yeah.
And I'm working on that now with my kids. But I tell people, make your kids make choices, right? And make them live up to the consequence. And my mother did, right? There are times I made a lot of poor choices there, Scott. I mean, I'm not, like I said, I'm not a choir boy. I haven't done everything right.
Yeah. And
there were consequences, right?
Yeah. No, I grew up the same piece.
A lot of kids don't get consequences right now.
Yep. And sometimes we tend to bubble wrap our kids these days and do all those kinds of things. So, so you know, and just to finish off, you know, the event piece, you're getting out of the plane, you got out of the plane, you know, was there a raft there that could that take care of you from there? Or was your adventure still continuing?
It was still continuing because when it was my turn to go out, the first light that I saw was 10F on the right, door on the right. So I started making my way out like this, everybody else. But since I started getting out, I looked out, there's no room on the wing, there's no room on the boat. And that's why I was inside the plane for about 7 minutes, waist deep in 36 degree water, Fahrenheit water, because there was no room on the wing or the boat for me. And I didn't know I was the last passenger out. I wasn't worried about that, but all of a sudden I'm Good Morning America, and one of the first pictures they show is me, a picture of me hanging out of the plane and me holding onto the lifeboat and water up to my waist. So that's when I realized, wow, I was either the last or one of the last people out of this thing.
And
I never got on the wing of the boat. I had to jump in and swim to the ferry to get off because I felt the plane shift. And what I found out later how that happened was when I talked to the ferry boat captain, one of the tugboat captains who hit the plane when he backed out, and it just shifted the plane, right? It wasn't a big hit. But when it shifted, the water started sloshing back and forth, and I felt water. I'm like, whoa, this puppy's going down. And it's like Titanic. It's like you don't want to be inside when it's going down.
No.
Right?
Yeah.
To get out. So that's why I jumped in and swam to the closest boat that I could find. That's how I got off the plane.
So from time from takeoff to time to hospital, I heard, you know, you guesstimate somewhere around 30 minutes.
Broke it down. You know, we broke it down based on the time intervals that people have told, like six minutes for the flight from takeoff to touch. And then it was about 12 to 15 minutes for me to get from that point from inside the plane to the triage center. And now it's another 5 or 6, 8 minutes to get to the hospital. So somewhere around 30 plus minutes.
Yeah.
From time we took off to me sitting in the hospital with nothing on.
So, you know, the days after, you know, the event, how long did it take for you to realize that, you know, life was going to change for you, that there was something else to do?
Well, things were changing pretty rapidly immediately.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you're in the middle of the game at that point, right? I mean, you got media hitting you. You got people calling you. You got your company still wants you to go to work. So there's a lot of things, but it really didn't hit me until the following weekend when I did my first speaking engagement, when I was asked to speak at my church, and you know, it was for men's breakfast, and I thought it was no big deal, right? But all of a sudden 500-600 people showed up, right?
Yeah.
It's like, whoa. But after I got done speaking, and I didn't know what I said that day, I had nothing prepared. I mean, I prayed to God, give me something to say, man, you know, bring it to me now, give me something. But an older lady, probably 80 or 90 years old, walked up to me and grabbed my arm and said, I was questioning if there was a God. I don't believe in miracles, but you're physical evidence that there is a God. Mm-hmm. And he does do miracles. And she thanked me.
Just looked
me in the eye and walked away. And two men in front of me started visibly crying. I've never seen two men cry like this in public.
Yeah.
And I'm like, and all of a sudden I'm thinking, well, what happened? And also I realized I just impacted somebody's life. Somebody now, at least before she dies, believes there's a God who does miracles. And because I'm here today and because I'm physical evidence. So this is what sort of being the transitions. I know where I got to go. How can I do it? But I know I have to have a different mission in my life.
So, you know, you've done the breakfast speech at the church and you've made that impact. You know, that's still a far ways away. And the habitudes piece of our audience talks an awful lot about is summoning the courage and the vision to not just think about it, to get it out of the ethereal and to actually put practical steps on it. So tell us about some of the practical steps you did to disengage from your full-time work that had been your, you know, 20, 30 year career to this new place that, as you said, you had nothing prepared. You know, you're brand new in business terms. You're a brand new startup that may have a future or not. Tell me just about some of those transition steps.
Well, one of the things that, you know, Tony was a great coach and mentor me during this whole time. He was coaching me and sort of giving me some guidance on what to look out for, what to do.
You know, and sorry for interrupting. It's got to be kind of nice to have, you know, one of the world's, if not the world's top coach helping you in business here. Yeah. You are leading an enchanted life, sir.
Well, here's the backstory to that backstory. That when I was head of security for those 5+ years of my time, when I would pick him up at the helipad or the airport or wherever I was picking him up, when we started a conversation, he'd always said, you know, he's still working for that company. Mm-hmm. He said, you got to get out of that. You got to go to work for yourself. You'll never be totally free until you work for yourself. And I would come up with excuses, and Canley, not a good guy to give excuses to, right? Yeah. He doesn't put up with much excuses, and Canley, he knows when you're not telling the truth. So, you know, there's no excuses left. So he was giving me some points. He said, call me when you get to LA, right? I'll sort of coach you on what you're going to be looking at. And he was giving me coaching. So that's what I knew that I had to do. So Tony's whole thing, right, is taking action. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I knew I had to take action, but I was making a lot of money.
Yeah.
I was making a ton of money. And my wife's global worldview, her number one, you know, life is about certainty. She likes certainty. She says, mm-hmm. I know I'm going to have a house. I'm going to have health insurance. I'm going to have money. And she always had that, right?
Yes.
At a high level, right? And here you want to go off and do what? Right? Yeah. So I had to give – it took me 5 years, Scott, to figure this game plan out. It wasn't immediate. I was then now still – now I'm speaking and doing this and doing the Tony stuff, right? And I was all over the board. But I knew I had to get out. Okay. So finally, about 5 years into it, and it was on the five-year anniversary, this happened. Yeah, CBS did a piece on my family. It was actually the first time CBS in the house. We did this piece on, and it was on the fifth anniversary. And I was on the evening news with Scott Pelley, right? So they followed me from Charlotte to New York to New Jersey. So I was in New Jersey on the 15th of July, of January of that year, and doing interviews and just doing my stuff. And about midnight, I got back to the hotel and I called her. I said, "Hey, how's everything going?" She said, "Hey, did Oracle call you today?" I said, "No." I knew I was going to be off. I was going to do my thing, right? I'm on TV all over the place. I said, "Did Oracle call you?" She goes, "No." She goes, "Maybe it's time for you to move and do this thing." I think she had to see it, right? She had to sort of see out. And so I promised her, I said, "If I do this, I'll make sure you have health insurance, you'll have a house. Your lifestyle won't change."
Yeah.
Mine has. I mean, I don't take these big cars anymore and these nice trips, right? But I said, so I had to give her certainty while I was in uncertainty.
So when you're balancing – Dave, when you're balancing your family's needs and wants, you know, as you transition, you talked about Tony being, you know, a good mentoring influence. And so can you speak a little bit more to that mentorship piece? You know, not all of us will have access to Tony, you know, in his Florida mansion and all those kinds of things. But
I don't have access to that either. Sorry? I don't have access to that. I don't have access to that either. I think everybody should have a mentor. It doesn't have to be a Tony Robbins. I was just blessed to be around that environment. Right? I mean, I have other mentors now, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm sure if I ever needed anything at that level, if I needed to, I could probably get to him some way to ask him a question, but I don't do that anymore. I mean, I've grown to a level now where I'm mentoring other people.
Yes.
So I think, I think everybody, especially through their life, probably does, but don't realize they have mentors who are guiding them, giving them guidance. And everybody needs a mentor. I mean, Michael Jordan had coaches, right? I mean, Tom Brady, who's the number one quarterback probably in the history of the NFL, has got a nutritionist, his personal trainer, his coaches. He's got coaching people. So the best need coaches and mentors. How about you, right? Why don't you have them? Yeah. And right now it's so easy to get. I mean, unfortunately, unlike when I was a young man and all you had was the Encyclopedia Britannica, right? You had to make network connections. Now you have the internet.
You can get help. Yeah. How would you recommend going about, you know, the average person, you know, who's thinking about transitioning, finding a mentor? I mean, can you think of any sources that you've seen that have worked for people to find that kind of?
Yeah. I just sort of referenced that. I mean, you know, I talk about virtual references and virtual mentors, because you don't have to now, you know, you know somebody directly. You can go out and read their books. You can go online. You can contact them by LinkedIn or Facebook. You can get a hold of anybody. And I have people, I just had one a few moments ago from beautiful Gulf, Ontario, just messaged me and asked me if I would mentor or talk to a police officer up in that area.
Yeah.
So, I mean, so the question is you don't, most people make it a should, right? Like Tony says, you got to make it a must.
Yeah.
You seek out and model those who view the outcome you want, and you can get a hold of those people in a lot of different ways.
Yeah.
I mean, I still contact people. I mean, I contacted a couple CEOs yesterday that I didn't know.
Very good.
There's so a great, you got to take the action.
There's a great Canadian mentorship story. A guy in the 1970s, he was from a black family. It took financial management at U of T, wanted a mentor. This is 1970s. So he drives down to someplace in Kansas where Berkshire Hathaway offices are of Warren Buffett. And he sat in Warren Buffett's office for 8 days in a row without an appointment. And on the eighth day, Warren Buffett came out and said, you know, I've got to just meet the man who thought it was worth 8 days of his time to meet me. And the guy's name is Michael Lee Chen, who does AIC Mutual Funds and was in 2014, was around the 20th richest person in the world through AIC Mutual Funds. And again, it's because Warren Buffett took him under his wing. And Michael had actually made extraordinary efforts to find worthwhile mentors along the way, similar to what you're doing. So just for the habit of the audience there, just, you know, hang yourself with people who are willing to open doors for yourself.
Well, one of the things I talk about, Scott, is proximity is power, right? Mm-hmm. You got to be around it. And, you know, it's interesting that Warren Buffett story, because when I was speaking in Omaha last few months ago, I asked if I could go to the steakhouse where Warren Buffett goes to.
Yeah.
Just in case the dude was around, right? Yeah. I did get my picture taken with his cutout. But, you know, you got to put yourself around proximity to these people. That's why if you go to these seminars, right? If you want to be around, go to the seminar, right? Be in that energy. And that's how I started with Tony. He didn't know me from Adam, right? I was one of those guys jumping up and down doing that.
Yep.
And then a couple years later, here I am in service.
So you made the 5-year transition, Dave, you know, with your wife's blessing and your family's, you know, doing well with it. You've got a story that, you know, some would consider, you know, it can be one of those moment stories. We have an attention deficit society, you know, it's now 9 years out since the event. But you've managed to breathe life into the business. And so a lot of people who we chat and coach to have something that's of a shorter term passion, but they aren't able to see how it could be viable down the long term. How have you made your business, you know, Dave Sanderson Speaks, viable as the story recedes into history?
Yeah, that's a great question, because it's out there. It's part of history. But as you're right, it starts fading a little bit as you hear further out. Now, we're coming into the 10th anniversary, and the movie came out last year. So there's other things that cycle through it. But I've really moved away from the Miracle on the Hudson side, because what I'm finding when I go out and speak and interact with people is two big lessons people want to talk about: how to really build your own personal leadership. How do you have personal leadership to be able to handle this stuff? And second, how do you grow from a traumatic life event? So I said, I looked at this, I'm like, I can have more impact with people really not talking a lot about the miracle, but talking about how I use that experience in leadership roles and building leadership, but also growing. That's why I did my TED Talk at Queen's University in Kingston. Mm-hmm. I wanted to get that message out there so I could help people. So I think what I tell people is, you know, you've got to keep your mind open. And one of the ways you do that is one of the things I just mentioned. You put yourself around people who can give you better information. You go to seminars, right? You get in contact with people. Let them mentor you. Let them give you some information and challenge you. That's why I have a team now from all over the country and all over now, even Canada. I've got two assistants in Canada to give me a world different centric perspective on what I need to be doing to really expand and be able to impact more people's lives. Yeah, this is the hub. But if you watch me, and next time you see me speak, you see me go on a whole different tangent right now, because I need to get to people's hearts in a way to help them to grow and survive.
So talk about that. You know, you're, you know, that 30-year industry guy, and a lot of folks are reluctant to take that energy step to break away because, you know what, the ego, the paycheck, the being needed is so entrenched in what you've done so far. So why am I going to shed that skin that served me, protected me, grown me over time for something that, you know, could be a skeleton that doesn't put meat and bones back on? Like, it could, my gosh, fail. You know, talk about personal leadership in terms of what an individual would need to have as personal leadership to actually take that step.
Well, I'll give you two different perspectives. Number one of the things that Tony teaches everybody is if you're going to make a commitment, we talk about making it a must. You make it a must and you burn the boats. You have to burn the boats. So you know what? I'm all in and I'm going to sacrifice and make it happen. So number one, you got to burn the boats. But second, what happened to me, it was sort of made me start figuring out how to make this shift. Is I got in touch with the CEO of a company in Dallas, Texas called Halftime. Mm-hmm. And it's based on a book by Bob Buford called Halftime. But when you hit that point in your career, your life, where you've hit it, you're doing well, but all of a sudden you realize there's something left out. I'm missing something, right? Money's not the only thing. And I started interacting with the CEO of Halftime, and he invited me to come out to Dallas. I, on my own dime, went to Dallas, right? I tell people that too. You got to invest in yourself. Yeah. And I did that going to Toronto. And that's how I'm a member of the Hero Club. Now, me doing work with Jeffrey Hazlett, I invested in myself and made that commitment. So I went to Halftime and all of a sudden started realizing the mentality of all these leaders have made that corporate shift to entrepreneurship or how to help non-for-profits or dig ditches in Africa, whatever it is. And all of a sudden I'm like, I can do this. You know, I hit that Halftime wall, right, where – yeah, so I tell people, if you want to make the move, you got to burn the boats and know all of a sudden it's like this is a halftime of your life. You got a whole another half of your life. What are you going to do to add significant value and enjoy the process of doing it?
Yeah.
And enjoy the process is the biggest part of that.
So well, the point there that you really brought up is, you know, how quickly do you have to burn your boats? In your case, you said it took 5 years before you made that complete detachment. So is it okay to have a slow burn before the boats actually disappear?
You got to have a game plan. And that's one thing it took me some time to figure out. And some of the people who were around me, some of the leaders that I was talking to, I'm not talking about Tony, I'm talking about other leaders, whether it was in the Red Cross or corporate leaders or some of my clients, and they knew what I was doing. I mean, I was very public, right? Heck, I'm in the media pretty much every week, so I'm doing something. But they all told me, make sure you have a plan, right? Make sure you have a plan before you get out, because when you make that cut, it's basically for good. And yeah, you better have a plan, because if you don't, then all of a sudden you go back down and then it's going to be your mental side and emotional side is going to work on you. So I took my advice from all these people who are telling me, have a plan before you get out.
And the reason, you know, Dave, when you and I chatted for the first time a month or so ago, I just instantly connected with you because you're real. And so in that spirit, you know, when you talk about a plan, that's a great term, but what are some of the key elements that you seem for a plan to have, to actually have value as you go and execute it? What worked for you?
Well, what worked for me is this, and I went back to something basic that I learned from one of my first Tony Robbins events. Mm-hmm. Is he talks about the six human needs, and everybody's got these driving needs, right? And one usually a primary need. So what I started putting my plan together, Scott, was based on the six needs of, you know, from certainty to variety to contribution to growth to significance and connection or love. And I made my plan based on does the criteria meet these six needs? Mm-hmm. So everything that I did, well, I'm going to go speaking. Well, can I meet those six needs of speaking? Yes, I can. How about writing a book? Yes, I can. So I started putting the plan together based on the six needs, and my primary need had shifted. Because most salespeople, and maybe you don't see this in Canada, but I see it a lot, still see it a lot. Salespeople are probably mostly personal significance driven. I mm-hmm. got to get the number, right? And I got to provide. If I don't get the number, I may be cut. So it's all about me getting the number. Once I made the shift, and this happened pretty much right after the plane crash, where, you know, it was all still about getting the quote and the number. But I said, you know what? I've got to take care of my teams better, you know? Mm-hmm. So I started focusing on giving them the support, letting them, checking my ego at the door, letting them do it. Good. So I started shifting my personal significance to contribution and growth. And also, as soon as I did that, man, I tell you what, everything opened up. So I based my initial plan on the six human needs that Tony talked about in each one of these areas and put my plan based on that.
Very cool. So when you've got that plan and you're executing it and you're having some good months, you know, but you're having some some, oh my gosh, what have I done moments. I remember starting up my wildlife sanctuary and my mortgage was $1,400 and I had $500 coming into the, you know, in revenue. I had to go bartend again just to make ends meet. This was a few years ago. I know I lost sleep, and sleep was sometimes a scary thing. So now, 30 years later, when we have somebody who's got a strong career identity, strong ego, strong needs identification with the position, and they take the break, and they hit their first speed bump or second speed bump, and they're going, man, I'm going to retreat. I'm going to stop the boats burning. You know, I'm going back. What are some of the coping strategies as far as personal leadership that you could suggest for folks to, you know, stay the course, to keep on going?
Well, that's a great question, because I hit that. I've hit that a number of times, but the one time I hit it probably 3.5 years ago when I started to do pretty well, right? See, I'm a sales guy from heart. Mm-hmm. So I could drive revenue, right? And revenue solves a lot of problems until you don't take care of the back end, the payables and receivables and all that stuff. And I wasn't getting collections. I wasn't getting receivables. So here I am trying to figure all this thing out. So I was driving, but I couldn't get it. So I hit that whole road. And one of the things that I learned, once again, not from Tom Hawkins and all these people, right, are you can't fail unless you quit, right? And you just keep persisting through it, right? You have to, and that's why I talk about persistence in my book. It's about persistence, right? You know, if you quit, you lost. But if I keep going, like my dad taught me before he died, Scott, the stock market was going out of control in 2009. It was horrible. Yep. I said, and he was on his last days. He had maybe another 2 years left. We were talking about this because he was talking about my finances, right? Because he was, he said, don't sell anything. If you sell, you lose. Just hold on and ride the tide. He said, this would happen during the Great Depression when I was growing up. Same thing.
Yeah. No. Nope.
He told me less about persistence, hanging in there, right? Just focusing on the outcome instead of all the things that are going on.
And so maybe relying on your mentors that you've cultivate along the way, that you're not alone, kind of piece.
And the second thing that I've done, and I tell people, is I've done this in the last year, which has changed everything, is getting yourself around a mastermind group. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm with a group of 10 guys now out of Nashville, Tennessee, and every Monday we get together and we beat each other up, right? We go after it. And they hold me to account. But they give me their strategies on how to handle these situations. Like I had that situation about accounts receivables and payables and things. So get yourself around a mastermind group. And that's one of the things that I'm starting to do now, is people have asked me to do that. So I'm starting to build one. And we're going to be sort of launching that in the next 6-7 weeks and being able to help people like they've helped me in the past, paying it forward.
Very cool. Hey, you've got something going on Amazon right now too, don't you?
I'm really excited. That opened up, once again, that when things you think are not opening up, things are open up, pathways open up. And that opened up with me in November. And I'm very fortunate that I was contacted by a gentleman, an assistant to one of the people, his name's Gary Vaynerchuk. Mm-hmm. And one of his people way down, it's not Gary. He said, he just emailed me, he said, check this thing out. So I said, okay. He sent me a video clip of him speaking in Copenhagen. And it was about the power of voice. The next technology wave is coming is the power of voice, AI, where you can just talk to things and things will do things for you, right? Mm-hmm. He said, you got to get on this wave. You got to get your own program on this Amazon Alexa platform. I said, what are you talking about? So he sort of walked me through it, and I contacted the guy. And now I have a daily show. It's a skill. It's called an Able Skill, right? Mm-hmm. Called Dave Sanderson Declassified. What I do is either myself or someone like you and me will get on. We'll take one topic in 5 minutes, declassify it. So instead of having this big topic of, you know, how do you handle this, we're going to talk about having persistence and what does it take to get persistence in 5 minutes. And it's out there on Amazon Echo right now. You enable the skill. Every day it will come up and you can hear great wisdom. And I check out everybody's wisdom on this, right? Because I'm learning stuff all the time. That's where I get a lot of my content.
You were just telling me about that today for the first time. So I'm going to make sure I subscribe to catch that, because it seems like you've got an awful lot to share.
We'll have you on it. And for 1 week, it'll be Scott and Dave show. And I'll let you take 3.5-4 minutes to declassify some strategies for people. And that way you'll give back to different platform audiences.
Well, thanks for the opportunity. People want to get a hold of your book, Moments Matter. Is it Amazon or through your website?
Both ways. You can go to Amazon and get either Kindle or the hard copy version, or go to my website and get the hard copy version. And if you go to my website, DaveSandersonSpeaks.com, I'll personally autograph it for you. If you go to Amazon, you'll get it, and I really am honored if you do that.
Yeah. Dave, I know you're off up to Canada tomorrow, aren't you?
I'm headed to beautiful Waterloo, Ontario tomorrow to a Leadership Ontario group out of Waterloo. I'm really excited. I love going to Canada. I go to about 5 to 6 times to Canada a year, and they treat me like gold. I love my Canadian friends.
Fantastic. I'm going to just mention his website one more time, DaveSandersonSpeaks.com. I always, do background checks on folks before I interview. Background checks is not the right word, but I check out what they're doing already. Dave's got 4 videos on there, and normally I'd give a cursory look. I was compelled to watch all of your videos, and including the last one, which I think was a full hour and whatnot. It's just that chock full of stuff. So for folks who are listening here, please migrate over to there and take a look. It is well worth your while. Dave, thanks so much for joining us today, and safe travels tomorrow. And I hope it's actually not too cold for you when you get to Waterloo tomorrow.
Well, I'm excited to go. Thank you for having me, Scott. And one more gift for your audience. If they want to text 393939 and put the word brace to number 4 impact, I'll send them as a gift. One of my first videos called Overcoming Adversity in Challenging Times. Free. They just text it. They'll get that. And I would say thank you for listening to that.
Fair enough. Now, can you just say that number one more time so if they were just copying it down?
393939.
Yeah.
And then put the word brace, the number 4, impact.
Okay.
And I'll ask you if you want the video, and then you say yes, and the video will be coming your way.
Very cool. Very nice. All right. Thank you very much, sir. And I look forward to catching you on stage or online again in the very near future.
I will have you on my show, on my Amazon show, and I'm excited to have you there, my man.
Cheers. Take care. Have a good one.
Thank you.
Bye now.